Good morning, everybody. I would like to start, of course, by thanking the organizers for putting together this beautiful, interesting conference. This talk that I'm going to give will be very exceptional. First, is the only theoretical talk in this session of experimentalists. And second is on the spintronic and spin-related subjects, which is absolutely nothing to do with what I'm going to tell. So given that, I also changed the title of the talk that was Quantum Field Theory Aspects of Graphene, and I moved to Curved Graphene Revisited. Of course, they all will be related. I'm very happy to be in this session, spintronic, that shows that physics is physics. No matter how you do the little apartheid, we still can, you know, talk together. So I will first show you the people that are at the Institute in the Graphene Group in Madrid. There are more than that, but we are some of them. Those are students and previous students of mine, which I'm particularly thankful because they keep me working much harder than what I naturally would do. And this work that I'm going to present at the end of this talk is in a work in progress done by Fernando de Juan, which is now a postdoc with Herfetic in Indiana, and Mauricio Sturla, which is a postdoc in our department coming from La Plata, Argentina. That's the summary of what I would like to tell. Although this is a theoretical talk and there will be some theoretical details, I think that experimentalists should care about it, because what I'm going to try to persuade you is that the Fermi velocity is not only energy dependent, as we already have seen in several talks in this conference, but also is space dependent. Okay, so what I'm going to try to put forward to you is the fact that there will not only be, when you approach the Dirac point, which to me is the most interesting region in graphene, there will not only be inhomogeneities, electron hole patterns and so on due to the singularity of the Dirac point, there will also be inhomogeneities due to the fact that any corrugation, strain or whatever in the samples, which is unavoidable as far as we think, will induce a Fermi velocity variation. So there will be another inhomogeneity to add to everything, which is a Fermi velocity that will be different in different parts of the samples. And I cannot emphasize how important that is, because, you know, the Fermi velocity is the only parameter that we have not only in the continuum model, in graphene in general, that's the only parameter. So any experiment you do, when you try to fit with theory, when you try to, you know, this is like the effective mass of the usual two-dimensional electron gases, or of the Fermi liquids. It's the only parameter. It permeates every single aspect of graphene. It's hidden there. So it may happen that you have to, you know, revise your experiments and see the thing on the view that the Fermi velocity could be varying. I will also try to show you how much you care about it. I mean, the order of magnitude of the effect, but it certainly will be there. So all this is rooted in something that I'm particularly fond of, which is the following. There is a popular approach that you all believe in, to strain graphene, which is based on tight binding. For some reason, tight binding is very popular. But I want to emphasize also the fact that Dirac physics and graphene exotics is not due to tight binding. It doesn't come from tight binding. It comes from the symmetries of the lattice and the low energy expansion. So although tight binding is nice and we understand and can do calculations, it's nothing fundamental on it. So this tight binding approach to ripples persuaded you that there will be something called gauge fields or vector fields or whatever. I mean, the electronics will couple to ripples and to structure through vector fields. You got it from tight binding. We are very happy. We accepted it. But there is another way of another model for treating the scarfed graphene, which I'm very fond of, because it you know, fills the gap between high and low energy physics. I'll tell you more about that later, which is a geometric covariant approach. It's like, okay, you are a spinor, you live in a curved space, so you should behave in a certain way. We me and my students, and we started with Paco with this, have put forward this model of based on like quantum field theory in curved space. And one of the predictions of this model is that the Fermi velocity would be space dependent. Whenever I have given talks on that, I kept listening to the same questions. Do you get that from tight binding? No. The next I put it, and they didn't say, so I don't care. So now I had to do the effort and get it from tight binding. Okay, so I thought it was, you know, tight binding effort. So I get it from my covariant relativity or whatever. So tight binding people should get it from wherever, but okay, I got it. So I'll just, now you will believe that this Fermi velocity variable, varying with space, is a reality, and you should care about it, I think. I will end up with some homework for the experimentalist, something I always like to do. So, oh, sorry. Curse didn't work, all right. Summary of graphene features, you all know this is a Dirac. The electronic properties are described by two-dimensional massless spinors, and there is where the physics of particle physics or whatever come into the play. This is the Hamiltonian, and as I emphasized before, there is a single parameter in this Hamiltonian, which is the Fermi velocity. The spinor structure, as you know, is given by the sublattice degrees of freedom, and there are two flavors associated to the two Dirac points. So this is the Hamiltonian around one of the Dirac points. Around the other one, you would put a star in the sigma and the Pauli matrices, because the two flavors are related by time reversal symmetry. So here is where it comes, the singularity of my talk. Real spin did not play much a role, that's what I think, in graphene till the advent of topological insulators. I was totally wrong. I should have removed the sentence from here, since I'm in this session where we see all the fun that you can get from spin. But anyway, I will not take spin into account at all in what I'm going to tell. Apart from the fact that if you're a spinner, it's because you have spin. So in a sense, spin is there. The Fermi velocity, as I say, is the only parameter, and everything depends on it. Why should I put forward the idea that you can describe the rippled or curved or string graphene as spinors in a curved space? Because we know that the spinor nature of the electronic excitations is not due to tight binding or to anything, it's due to the symmetries of the lattice, and we also know that it is very Dirac points are very robust under deformations, I mean mild normal deformations under curvature and so on. So I think the spinor will be happy to live in this curved space, and I think this is a very natural and a very useful approach if you know all the machinery as I did. So it's nothing special here, it's just simple. And since you are a spinner, you live in a curved space, you can use the machinery. This is just to remind you that the Fermi, the Dirac points, the Fermi, I mean the fact that you have Fermi points instead of Fermi surfaces. And the special relation is linear around those points, and then is described by the Dirac equation, is a very robust feature. And that's the basis of the approach, of the covariant approach. So you will continue being spinor even if the lattice is distorted. This is a very brief review of my previous title, Quantum Field Theory Aspects of Graphene. I want to mention, although Alessandra Lanzara gave a very nice talk yesterday about it, how is that Fermi velocity depends on the energy. This is, I think that, I know, the work we did with Paco and with Jose Gonzalez was based on, we saw the Hamiltonian, we turned to a Lagrangian morphology, and we saw that this is very much like QED, so we could copy-paste from the books of QED the results for graphene. It turned out that it wasn't that easy, but it doesn't matter. So the prediction of the renormalization of the Fermi velocity has been lying there and dormant there for 20 years, not only because there was no graphene, but also because I think that nobody could care less about it. Those were high energy people, crazy, trying to intrude into a condensed matter community. That's why graphene is so beautiful to me, because it's really, I mean, removing all these prejudices and all these barriers that we are building around us, you know. So now that this Fermi velocity apparently is measured, then we can maybe be more open to other predictions of theory that will be, would look also wild. This is the experiment by André Geim and his group. Elias is the first, I guess. What they did in suspended graphene, and they measured the cyclotron mass, and they saw this amazing changes of the cyclotron mass, which is directly related to the Fermi velocity with the energy, and the energy they related it with the doping or the N density. And this is the talk by Alessandra, I mean, this is what Alessandra described yesterday for us. And there are a few other works also, as Alessandra mentioned, that means that really the Fermi velocity will be energy dependent. This is just the talk that I gave in Salamanca, a beautiful town in the center of Madrid, and of Spain, sorry, which those kind of, yeah, could be, but it's not. With this type of riches, and this is a talk that I used to give because I like the idea, really, that graphene is a bridge between high and low energy physics. And this is a comparison between the renormalization of Fermi velocity in graphene and in QED. The Fermi velocity is essentially the inverse of the coupling constant of graphene. This is a plot of QED, particle physics. This is the U1, how it renormalizes. This is alpha QED. This is Fermi velocity if there would be a one in the high energies. And this is a plot that André gave to me very reluctant, because he thought that there was no beauty on it. I find it beautiful. Exactly the Fermi velocity or inverse coupling constant with the energy. And you see that even the slope is similar, although this is not really something to take very carefully. Not because of this experiment, which I think is wonderful, but because of those, because the only measure here is a line in 100 GeV, and then the zero GeV measurement done by condensed matter physicists and the structure, I mean, on the electron charge. I want to mention a very interesting thing is that in QED, the alpha QED is renormalized because the electric charge is renormalized, while in graphene, the electric charge is not renormalized, but the Fermi velocity is, and the two conspire to have a very similar renormalization. And I also like the fact that those plots look similar, and there is some 10 to the 13 orders of magnitude between this and that. I mean, so, and I persuade you that going to 100 GeV, as these people at CERN are doing now, and finding the Higgs there or whatever, is as hard as going to a few milli electron volts, as this group did. So I think this is really nice. And now I turn to my real topic, which is graphene. I don't have to persuade you. The previous speaker, Barbaros, also mentioned that the ripples will be there all the time, and strains and tensions in the samples will always be present. So what are the consequences? And lately, we know also that the strains can be controlled, and you can do wonderful things, ripples, wrinkles, balloons with graphene. So this subject of strain graphene, to me, is even more interesting than bilayer, but maybe one will not be that useful. Anyway, this is one of the subjects that are fascinating to me yet, and I think they are not yet closed. I mean, there are still things to be understood and to be determined in this field. So that's what I told you before. This I borrowed this view graph from Paco. Essentially, what this says here is that if you do type binding and you have a piece of graphene which is strained and what, one which is not, there is a mismatch between the case, which can be seen as an effective gauge field. This is the approach of strained graphene that we all have taken. And this is the approach that I'm particularly kind of, because, well, because I say it's natural and I had this tool, so I could use them. That's what is basically what happens when you are a vector or a tensor or anything, any geometric object, and you are in a curved surface. In order to move from one point to another, you have to be accompanied by what is called connections, because otherwise you will not remain parallel to yourself. This we know perfectly in the case of vectors. If you move a vector in a curved surface, then you have to rotate the direction in order to keep it parallel. And with spinors, it's the same. So there is a machinery perfectly well known that tells you how to write the Dirac equation in a curved surface. And the machinery that you can be read from the books, and it's really extremely simple, and probably you all did in the BA exercises much harder than that one. Essentially, what it says is that there are two main changes in this equation. One is the one that we already are reading to accept because we got it also from tight binding. It's like there will be a vector field accompanying your move because you are a vector and you are curved. But there is, what is new in this approach is that there will also be, because the gamma matrices are also have a vector index there, the gamma matrices will also depend on space-time. They will turn into the gamma matrix space-dependent sigma or gamma matrices. And this has the consequence that if you want to read the Hamiltonian in a flat space, the Hamiltonian curved space, you want to read it with flat language, then what you will easily see is that, okay, you have these curved gamma matrices, Pauli matrices that depend on space, so you will say that there is a Fermi velocity that depends on space accompanying the flat usual constant sigma matrices. And this is the origin of this space-dependent Fermi velocity that I'm advocating here. The spin connection is something you can work out and is nothing special. A very nice development that occurred in the late months or half a year is that these fictitious gauge fields came into reality after the observation by the group of Michael Cromy here and the prediction by Paco and Andre and Misha Kasnason, other people, that if you were able to strain the samples in such a way as to create homogeneous magnetic fields in a region strong enough, then perhaps you could be able to see Landau levels, fictitious Landau levels, or real Landau levels from fictitious magnetic fields. And this is that was a beautiful suggestion that apparently was seen on this Michael Cromy experiment. And we also suggested something that has not yet been observed. So since the best experimentalists of the field are here, I would like you to, I encourage you to try to see Arnold Bohm interferences from ripples in graphene. So there is this nature physics where we suggest, similar to what Paco and Andre did, that if you are able to draw a closed path for the electrons and we give you hints of how to do it, then the interference that you will measure in the absence of a ripple and in the presence of a ripple will be different. And this can be used as a micro strain detector because the regime where this will be seen, as this is an interference experiment, will not need enormous magnetic fields. You will be able to have some observable interferences from weak magnetic fields. Okay, now I'm coming to this, which was in this paper also, because I will now to address the question of why the covariant approach, quantum field theory in curved space, and the tight binding strain elasticity approach why do they look so different? And how can it be that if they both are good descriptions of the low energy properties of the system, and why wouldn't they agree? So one of the discrepancies is that one I already mentioned. Apparently there is no easy way to get the Fermi velocity dependent on space from tight binding. But there is something more important, is that if you take a ripple like that, this bump, the effective gauge field that you get from elasticity, which is written here from the strain, will have this trigonal symmetry, you know, this is intensity of the field. While in the covariant approach, if you compute the spin connection, so the fictitious gauge field associated to this bump, you get something that is perfectly axially symmetric. So you start with an equation. This C is the, you describe the ripple as a C of R. Okay, so, and then you, any F of R is like you describe the surface embedded in a three-dimensional null space, like X is X, Y is Y, and then C depends on X and Y. And that's how you get the metric and everything. And then you get a fictitious magnetic field. Remember that gauge fields or vector fields are not physical or nothing. They could be different and give rise to no physics. They could be gauged away. So that's why I'm talking about magnetic field. The effective magnetic field, which is what is observable or what really will contribute to observable things, is very different in the two approaches. So this is a summary of what is different. The geometric or covariant approach will give you a space-dependent Fermi velocity that you will not get easily or directly from elasticity. The effective gauge fields do have the symmetry of the deformation in the case of a covariant, while they do have different symmetries in the elasticity approach. And there is something very important, which is the dimension of the gauge fields that we're getting here are proportional to derivatives of the metrics. This is the connection, it doesn't matter. Now, see, if you want to compare these two approaches, since we need a metric and you do have a strain tensor, it's easy to build a metric from the strain tensor. This is an obvious thing to do. And if you do that and then compare these two gauge fields, the connection with the gauge field, you see immediately that the gauge field in the elasticity approach is directly related to the strain tensor, while the gauge field in the covariant approach will be a derivative of the gauge, of the strain tension, of the strain tensor. Another discrepancy is that with in-plane strains, you do get gauge fields and observable things in the elasticity approach, while in the covariant approach, in order to get the real spin connection, you need intrinsic curvature. So you really need to be curved. There is no nonsense. Or for instance, a cylindrical thing will not give rise to anything. This is flat. This extrinsic curvature or this uniaxial strains will give rise to nothing. The last important discrepancy is that the gauge field that you get here and the velocity and so on are material independent, while here in the elastic approach there will always be this parameter which can be related to the electron phone coupling, which is material dependent. So the question I'm asking is V of X predicted here a physical effect? I mean, will it give rise to observable things? Do we have to care about it? And so what we are doing in a work in progress that I hope it will appear in condensed matter tomorrow if I can finish today, is based in two things. One is like, what is the quantum field theory approach to building a Lagrangian? Is give me your symmetries and I tell you who you are. Okay, so if you Lorentz, you are Lorentz invariant, then you will be a irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. So you have to be either a scalar or a vector or a tensor, very prescribed. If you are a scalar, this is your Lagrangian, because it's the only scalar quantity that I will build with derivatives and this and that. So that is a very nice and precise way of building Hamiltonians or Lagrangians from the symmetries and the nature of your nature. I mean, so you tell me what kind of particle you are. Well, you don't tell me anything. I tell you what you can be. You can be a scalar, a vector, a tensor, or a spinor. That's all you can be. Now, if you choose to be a spinor, I'll tell you what is your action, if you're Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. If you choose to be a vector, I'll tell you who you are. If you are massless, you are f mu nu squared. If you are massive, you are d mu a squared. And this is fixed and very nice. And this is based on the, it's very similar to the low energy approach in graphene, because it's like once you went to very low energies and you did the continuum limit, you cannot care about details of the lattice or high energy details. So there also you could build a, say, a Hamiltonian based only on symmetry considerations. In any case, suppose that we do this game of I want to build a Hamiltonian that will have the trigonal symmetry of the hexagonal lattice, which is C3 times C2, is not C6, it doesn't matter. Then, what are the ingredients that I have in my hands in order to build a Hamiltonian? What I have is the Pauli matrices, which are covariant under this symmetry, the vector Q, the strain tensor, Uij, and with this, I have to build my Hamiltonian. Now, the important notice that is well known and is already in the old papers by about elasticity by Paco and in the review, Gates review that we brought down, is that there is an invariant tensor in C3, which is this one. These are the nearest neighbor vectors of any of these points. It's easy to see that this is invariant, because if you rotate this 60 degrees, then each one of these indices will turn into the other, and when you sum up all the three, that will be invariant. So this is another tensor we have to play with, I mean, when we want to construct our axioms. If you do that game, just blind, I mean, not based on any dynamics, just say, okay, I do the geometric approach. I take my geometric objects and build a scalar object Hamiltonian that will have derivatives and everything and will give us question of motion. Then you see that if you contract, I mean, you have objects that have two indices and can be contracted with a flat metric to get the Hamiltonian, and this is this object, sigma dj, that you can contract with gij or with delta ij, and will give you the flat Hamiltonian. There is also this object that will give you give rise to the what I call the geometric gauge field, something that is proportional to the derivative of a string tensor, and is a gauge field. And there will be also this term, which is proportional to the strain tensor. It has a K on it, this derivative, and it has a sigma Pauli matrix, and this is what will give rise to space-dependent Fermi velocity. On the other hand, you have terms with an odd number of indices that can be contracted with this tensor or with the epsilon totally antisymmetric, which is also invariant. From those, you will get the trigonal gauge field, I mean the elastic gauge field, as in the first order, and you will get also the trigonal warping term. So this is like a dictionary that will give you hints on what kind of things you can get based only on symmetries. Now, if you go and do the hard work of do I get it from tight binding, and you can write the tight binding Hamiltonian and do a systematic expansion either on the strain or on K. And then you see that you immediately get the what I told you, all these terms. And if you expand, if you expand in only in Q, you get what you usually get. If you expand only in delta T, then you get this gauge field that you get in the traditional approach. But if you expand in both, you get this term, which is exactly the space-dependent Fermi velocity. Those are the works that are related to symmetry, and I think they are very important and interesting. This is what we are doing, and I think that Vitor will also talk about something like that tomorrow. So why am I going through all this. Okay, let me say something. Should we care about it? What am I saying? What I'm saying is, first, that a space-dependent Fermi velocity will also be obtained from tight binding if you go to expand in the next order, okay, in next order expansion. So that could be a physical reality. To me, it was always a physical reality, but it doesn't matter. So should you care? What is the order of magnitude of what we are talking about? This is we worked out this example of the bump. The correction in the Fermi velocity, which is here, will be of order alpha. In the case of this ripple like that, alpha is simply the relation between the height and the width of the ripple. It could be 1% or even less percent. So does it matter? It matters when there are no other effects, or it matters when you are going to do an experiment with enough accuracy as to care about few percents or few per million, whatever. So to me, this is similar to the Fermi velocity renormalization. It's the same order of magnitude. It's the same kind of thing. But it could change the view of all these inhomogeneities and all these things. For instance, you read always in the papers like these electron hole paddles. It is written, the only parameter that we have is the Fermi velocity that we fix to whatever. And ever, hence, they derive all these inhomogeneities. Maybe if the Fermi velocity is not such homogeneous itself, the whole view of the experiment could change. So this is just, I finished by saying that I think that we have to make more effort to correlate in experiments, you know, tensions on ripples or whatever with electronics, and this I think is very inspiring. This work by Jeannie Lau that sees some correlation between shapes and transport, but I think more work is needed. And so my conclusion is: pay attention to the Fermi velocity. It is not the constant that it looks like. It does not only vary with energy, but it will also vary with space. And these are the homework that I would like to give to the experimentalists. This I already gave it to you in 2010. I gave you this homework: establish the existence or not of a gap in the clean neutral system. This I put a question mark. I'm not sure that this is yet decided. To me, it's yes, no, there is no gap. This is what, but okay, Andre, you're nodding. You think that there is a gap? No gap, okay, wonderful. So as not everybody agrees with this, I think that it would be very nice if we all agree that there will be no gap driven by interactions or by anything, apart from what I know we know of substrate and things, in the clean material. Then I also gave us a homework to measure the variations of the Fermi velocity at low energies. Thank you. This is done. Wonderful. But I also gave you this, this homework: measure the variation of the Fermi velocity with the curvature in ripple samples. Eva Andre was about doing that some years ago, but then she decided that it was some finance or whatever. So I invite you to revise this data that seemed to indicate that there were different Fermi velocities in different portions of the sample. So this is the next homework: establish the correlation or not of morphology and electronics. And be aware, when you interpret your experiments, that there may be effects of inhomogeneities in the Fermi velocity. This is all. Thank you.
So maybe one or two short questions.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question.
Yes, Maria, I have a comment and a question. Comment is, we did measure variation of the Fermi velocity across the sample, 5%. I'll show that tomorrow. It may correlate with the local density with puddles, so that may actually be the reason, maybe the Fermi velocity dependence on energy, which we also see. Now, my question is, how does your story about strain, how is it affected by Coulomb interaction? Coulomb interaction doesn't break any symmetry. So from your arguments, it shouldn't do anything. And we know that in other scenarios, it opens gaps and things like this. So can you comment about putting in Coulomb interaction in your story?
Yeah, my story on symmetries is based on what is your non-interacting, what you would call single particle Hamiltonian. Okay, so you give me your symmetries, and I give you the vacuum. I mean, I give you the non-interacting Hamiltonian. To that, you add interactions. Okay, and then interactions do things and make the vacuum unstable very often. It's like you start with the Fermi liquid, you add interactions, you get the superconductor. So the symmetry approach is giving you the Fermi liquid, say, the free non-interacting Hamiltonian. To this, you add interactions. And interactions, of course, do things. So so you want to say that ripples are interactions? Because you see, the only thing is that if you live in a curved space, you are never free. That's life. I mean, curvature means, gravitation means, attraction means you are not free in a curved space. So you're free, your single particle Hamiltonian in a curved space will contain those terms, gauge fields and space-dependent Fermi velocity. To that, you add the Fermi Coulomb interactions. There is a covariant way to do that, and then you will end up in whatever, a superconductor or an antiferromagnet or whatever. So did I answer your question? No. Okay, sorry.
Because we're running out of time, just a comment, okay? In my talk, I just described suspended samples, which are ballistic suspended samples, and we can go down to energies 0.11 MeV, and there is no gap to this accuracy. So whether there is a gap of 10 microelectron volts, we don't know, and probably will never know, okay?
I'll put a tip here.
Okay, so I think in view of the time, we should probably move on and postpone further discussions for lunch. So the next talk is going to be by Irina Grigorieva from Manchester on magnetism in graphene induced by point defects.